China, the government's Bank of China, was setting up a joint venture with Rosemont Seneca. The Bank of China is an enormously powerful financial institution, but the Bank of China is very different from Bank of America. While both have massive financial resources, the similarity ends there. The Bank of China is government-owned, which means that its role as a bank blurs into its role as a tool of the government. The Bank of China provides capital for China's economic statecraft, as scholar James Riley puts it. Bank loans and deals often occur within the context of a government goal. As one Chinese scholar puts it, these government-owned entities are difficult for Westerners to fully comprehend because the methods of government control are deep. Chinese SOEs, or state-owned enterprises, are embedded in a complex state-controlled network, including state ministries, security forces, and the Communist Party. As a result, such a bank is extraordinarily linked to the government's ruling elite. For example, the chairman of the Bank of China, Tian Guoli, also serves as secretary of the Communist Party of China committee at the bank. Tian was familiar with both Joe Biden and John Kerry. Vice President Biden had met with executives of the Bank of China during his 2011 official visit to China. 10 days after Hunter Biden left China with his father, Rosemont Seneca and the Bank of China created an investment fund called Bohai Harvest RST, or BHR, a name that reflected who was involved. Bohai, or Bohai, the innermost gulf of the Yellow Sea, was a reference to the Chinese stake in the company. The RS referred to Rosemont Seneca. The T was Thornton. The fund enjoyed an unusual and special status in China. BHR touted its unique Sino-US shareholding structure and the global resources and network that allowed it to secure investment opportunities. Funds were backed by the Chinese government. In short, the Chinese government was literally funding a business that they co-owned along with the sons of two of America's most powerful decision-makers. The Chinese government-funded Bohai Harvest RST prominently mentioned Rosemont Seneca's involvement in the fund on its website, that is, until inquiries were made about Biden's and Heinz's involvement. Subsequently, any mention was scrubbed or abbreviated RST. Jonathan Lee, chief executive officer of Bohai Harvest, says, BHR represents a mixture of private enterprise and SOE, state-owned enterprise. Sheen Wang, managing partner of the firm, notes the advantages of having a connected Western business partner like Rosemont Seneca. Just by virtue of being an SOE, there is the perception, rightly or wrongly, that there will be some cross-cultural issues. Having us and our global resources there as a financial investor and serving as a conduit can facilitate the transaction. Rosemont Seneca's role, according to internal Chinese documents, was to spearhead efforts in the United States. The deal was remarkable. Rosemont Seneca was getting something for the first time that no other Western firm had in China, a private equity cross-border investment fund formed in the Chinese government's Shanghai Free Trade Zone. The Shanghai Free Trade Zone had been established only months earlier by the Chinese government's State Council and personally championed by China's Prime Minister Li Keqiang. Why, with all the financial firms doing business in China that had far more experience, a larger footprint, and a history of doing deals there, did the Chinese government pick Rosemont Seneca? The advantages that Biden on Heinz's firm got were enormous. Along with Chinese government capital to invest, by operating from the Shanghai Free Trade Zone, they could take Chinese government funds and invest there or take them out of the country and invest them in the United States or elsewhere. No one else had such an arrangement in China. Rosemont Seneca was essentially placed first in line. The Chinese government's deal in December 2013 with the Sons of America's Vice President and Secretary of State occurred in lockstep with aggressive territorial claims it was making in the Pacific. Eli Ratner, writing in Foreign Affairs, describes how, in early 2014, China's efforts to assert authority over the South China Sea went from a trot to a gallop. Chinese ships began massive dredging projects to reclaim land around seven reefs that China already controlled in the Spratly Islands, an archipelago in the sea's southern half. In an 18-month period, China reclaimed nearly 3,000 acres of land. Contrary to assurances by the Chinese President Xi Jinping that they had no intention to militarize the South China Sea, Beijing began rapidly transforming its artificial islands into advanced military bases replete with airfields, runways, ports, and anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems. In short order, China has laid the foundation for control of the South China Sea. The Rosemont-Seneca deal was lucrative for the Bidens and appears, on behalf of the Chinese government, strategically timed to go along with China's aggressive territorial claims. But it was not the only deal that occurred at this critical time. The following year, in July 2014, Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Beijing for a series of sensitive, high-level meetings with Chinese government officials. As the Washington Post put it, Chinese and U.S. relations were in a downward spiral. Kerry was there as part of the so-called Strategic and Economic Dialogue, or S&ED, which had been erected to provide a forum to hash out such tough diplomatic, commercial, and military issues between the two rivals. In 2014, there were several of those issues. Sanctions against North Korea, opening up China to greater investment from the West, containing and dealing with Iran's nuclear program, those Chinese territorial claims in the South China Sea, and a climate change agreement. Before the talks began, Kerry, dressed in a blue blazer and khakis, walked the Great Wall of China. He was joined by the U.S. Ambassador to China, Max Baucus, and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. He was cautiously optimistic about what might be accomplished. The Chinese government had greeted his appointment as Secretary of State a year earlier with a sense of relief. They found his predecessor, Hillary Clinton, too hawkish on China for their tastes. As a lengthy editorial in the official government China Daily put it, Clinton always spoke with a unipolar voice and never appeared interested in the answer she got. Kerry understands the true multipolar nature of the 21st century world. He listens to the answers he gets. They liked his low-key and quiet style. Although he may not abandon traditional U.S. concerns on promotion of democracy and human rights issues, he will express them in talks privately and quietly, without trying to embarrass or undermine his interlocutors. With his arrival at Foggy Bottom, they surmised, there is an excellent chance of Sino-U.S. ties improving significantly during his term of office. Even more auspiciously, the deal between his stepsons Rosemont Seneca and the Bank of China had been inked 7 months earlier. Kerry spent 2 days in intensive talks with Chinese officials in Beijing behind closed doors. The morning of July 9th commenced with John Kerry standing next to Chinese President Xi Jinping in front of a collection of interspersed Chinese and American flags. President Xi called for a commitment on both sides to boost Sino-U.S. economic ties. Kerry echoed these sentiments before the leaders went into a private session. Much of what was discussed occurred behind closed doors, but there were some flashes for the public. After a lunch in the Great Hall of the People, John Kerry was invited to pick up a musician's guitar, which he strummed for the assembled guests. In private discussions, Kerry's focus was on North Korea and Chinese hacking of American computers. Publicly, he touted the economic ties between the two countries. As he put it, China and the United States represent the greatest economic alliance trading partnership in the history of humankind, and it is only going to grow. Meanwhile, as the Secretary of State was engaged in high-stakes secret discussions with his Chinese counterparts in Beijing, other private, commercial discussions were being held with Chinese officials. These talks did not involve the U.S. government. A former subsidiary of a Chinese government company that was close to the Chinese military was beginning discussions with another Rosemont entity. The Chinese company, Gemini Investments, was interested in purchasing Rosemont Realty, a firm controlled by John Kerry's stepson and whose leadership included Hunter Biden and close Kerry advisor Devon Archer. At this important diplomatic juncture in U.S.-Chinese relations, with so much at stake in military, diplomatic, and economic terms, a Chinese government-connected company was looking to become business partners yet again with the families of America's Secretary of State and Vice President. The eye-popping multi-billion-dollar deal that would result a year later would make those connected to the company a lot of money and raise serious questions about a massive conflict of interest. Archer and others were all too happy to tout Rosemont Realty's political ties to Vice President Joe Biden. As Archer was described in a 2014 corporate biography, Mr. Archer is the general partner and chairman of Rosemont Realty, which he founded together with Mr. Hunter Biden. Rosemont Realty played up the connection when pitching opportunities for investors. In a company prospectus from Rosemont Realty watermarked confidential, it was a key consideration that Hunter Biden, son of Vice President Biden, is on the advisory board. To run Rosemont Realty, Hines, Archer, and Biden tapped another close Kerry confidant to run the day-to-day operations. They tasked fellow Yale graduate Daniel Burrell with building the real estate business from the ground up. Burrell, who hails originally from upstate New York, worked on Kerry's 2004 failed presidential campaign. Burrell called John Kerry an incredible mentor. A Los Angeles Times article from October 2004 described Burrell's move to Los Angeles to run the local campaign. He came to L.A. with no car, no place to stay, living, as a favor to Kerry, at one of his supporters' place, and arranged for fundraisers featuring Hollywood types. In 2009, Burrell ventured out to the foothills of north-central New Mexico to set up Rosemont Realty's corporate headquarters. He settled into a building in the state capital, Santa Fe, on historic Garfield Street near the rail yard, a cultural hub in the center of the city. Rosemont put the mayor of Santa Fe on the payroll, which is legal in New Mexico. Within a year, the company had purchased the state's largest commercial real estate company, BGK, which had a $1.5 billion commercial real estate portfolio. As Burrell describes it, he was soon jetting around looking for trophy buildings in several states. Within a matter of the next 4 years, the company accumulated office buildings from the Southwest to New England. Rosemont Realty erected regional offices outside their headquarters in Albuquerque, Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, Houston, New York, Peoria, Arizona, San Antonio, Texas, Washington, D.C., and Tulsa, Oklahoma. In mid-2014, just as the Rosemont-Seneca deal with the Bank of China was getting off the ground, Burrell began holding discussions with a Chinese subsidiary called Gemini Investments Limited about buying Rosemont Realty. Gemini might have appeared to be just like any other investment company. Publicly traded on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, it offered itself as a conventional real estate investor. However, as can often be the case with China, tracing corporate ownership yields some interesting results. While Gemini Investments is a publicly traded stock, it is called an indirect subsidiary, and control of the company is retained by its parent company, Sino-Ocean Land. Gemini Investments director and honorary chairman is Li Ming. His corporate ties are to some of the most sensitive and politically important corporations in China. He also served for several terms running as a member of the Chinese Communist Party's so-called People's Political Consultative Conference. Gemini Investments parent, Sino-Ocean Land, is a development company with a large footprint in Beijing, as one journalist put it, and is one of the largest real estate companies in Beijing. In an old bio, Devon Archer describes it as the largest SOE real estate development in China. It has deep ties to the Chinese government. Sino-Ocean Land, for example, launches and funds programs under the direction of the Central Commission of the China Communist Youth League and the government's Ministry of Education, according to corporate records. In turn, Sino-Ocean Land is connected to a company called the China Ocean Shipping Company, or COSCO. The chairman of Sino-Ocean Land is also chairman of COSCO. The Sino-Ocean Land website states that Sino-Ocean Group originated from COSCO. Until 2011, Sino-Ocean Land was a subsidiary of COSCO, and one of its website backgrounds is a photo of the COSCO headquarters. They share the same address. COSCO was founded in 1961 and is a state-owned company. With palatial headquarters in Ocean Plaza in the Xicheng District in Beijing, its corporate offices face the headquarters of another pillar of Chinese government power, the Bank of China, Rosemont's partner in the Bohai Harvest deal. Costco is one of those state-owned enterprises, or SOEs, that populate the corporate world in China. But even within the ranks of Chinese government-controlled companies, Costco is unique. Costco is widely seen by authorities in Asia and the West as deeply embedded in and tied to the Chinese military establishment. In particular, Costco had strong organizational links with both the Chinese People's Liberation Army, or PLA, and the People's Liberation Army Navy, or PLAN. As the academic journal Maritime Affairs puts it, it is well known that the state-owned China Ocean Shipping Company, Costco, has close links with the PLA. The Chinese call Costco the fifth arm of the PLAN, and Costco ships are often referred to as Zhanjian, or warships. Costco has a long history of clandestine work overseas and general troublemaking as far as American interests are concerned. According to secret leaked State Department cables, Costco was reportedly shipping material for Syria's weapons development program, probably from North Korea. In 2015, officials in Colombia detained a Costco vessel that was alleged to have been illegally shipping thousands of cannon shells and explosive material. The company had listed the cargo as grain on a shipping manifest. In 1996, 2,000 smuggled Chinese assault rifles were seized near San Francisco and were known to have been brought through the port of Oakland on a Costco ship. More broadly, Costco has built a global footprint covering vast corners of the world. U.S. naval experts say that those commercial activities by Costco are perfectly structured to align with Chinese naval strategy. According to Rear Admiral Michael McDevitt, USN retired, with the China Ocean Shipping Company, a state-owned enterprise providing global logistical services, Beijing enjoys built-in shore-based support structure at virtually all the major ports along the Pacific and Indian Oceans. This has become a successful approach to logistic sustainment halfway around the world from Chinese bases. So, when you navigate your way through the ownership of the Rosemont entities in the United States and Gemini Investments, it becomes strangely clear that a company connected to Sons of the Vice President and Secretary of State was negotiating to secure a deal with a company whose ties could be traced back to the fifth arm of the Chinese Navy. It would be the second large and profitable deal that the son of the vice president and the stepson and friends of John Kerry would strike with Chinese government-connected companies as both statesmen were negotiating with Beijing. In short, as Secretary of State John Kerry and Vice President Joe Biden were engaged in sensitive, high-stakes negotiations with the Chinese government, their sons' companies were cutting yet another deal with a company connected to the Chinese government. During his tenure as Secretary of State, Kerry was criticized for being soft on China despite China aggressively laying claim and expanding its presence in the South China Sea. Alarm bells were going off all over the region because of this unilateral expansion. But Kerry played it cool. As Bloomberg News put it in one headline, Kerry's soft words blunt U.S. hard power in the South China Sea. Critics noted that when it came to Chinese territorial claims in Asia, Beijing wanted to have negotiations with countries in the region individually, excluding both the United States and Japan, to make it easier for the large power to intimidate smaller regional players who questioned their territorial claims. In a move that surprised and troubled some in the region, Kerry effectively endorsed China's strategy to isolate countries like the Philippines in these negotiations by refusing to have the United States take a side in the territorial dispute. As another observer put it, if these efforts by China succeed, then the U.S. and Japan will effectively be sidelined, which itself would be a win for the Middle Kingdom. Kerry was also clear to state publicly that he saw no need to contain China. This was in contrast to his predecessor Hillary Clinton's posture. His words and position were praised by Beijing. Chinese government officials praised Kerry for his low-key approach to relations with China. Consider this dispatch from the Chinese embassy about a meeting between Kerry and Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. John Kerry agreed with the ideas and way of thinking from the Chinese side on developing the U.S.-China relations. He said that the U.S. side appreciates China for its positive and conducive efforts in promoting the talks on Iranian nuclear issue and the political settlement of the Syrian issue and others. The two sides should continue to strengthen communications and consultations in major regional hotspot issues and to enrich the contents of the new model of major country relationship between the U.S. and China. Privately, the business negotiations between the Biden and Kerry families and Chinese entities continued. Publicly, Secretary of State Kerry engaged with the very same Chinese government in diplomatic negotiations. In November 2014, Kerry hosted the Chinese foreign minister in his hometown of Boston, where they dined on Maine cod and Boston cream pie while overlooking Boston Harbor. By December 2014, Gemini was negotiating and sealing deals with Chris Hines's and Hunter Biden's Rosemont on several fronts. That month, Gemini bought out the Rosemont Opportunities Fund II, an offshore investment vehicle run by Rosemont, for $34 million. Larger deals would follow. In May 2015, Kerry went to Asia to meet with his Chinese counterparts to readdress the difficult issues between the United States and China. As Josh Rogan recounts, Chinese officials told me that the Chinese saw further weakness when Secretary of State John Kerry visited Beijing in May. According to the Chinese readouts, Kerry told his hosts that the U.S. wanted to work with them on a range of issues, including North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and the two powers shouldn't let the South China Sea issue get in the way of broader cooperation. The Chinese interpreted it as a signal that the U.S. was not ready to confront them. By August, Rosemont Realty announced that Gemini Investments, still run from Costco headquarters, was buying a 75% stake in the company. It was the second major deal Rosemont struck with China in just 18 months. The terms of the deal included a $3 billion commitment from the Chinese, who were eager to purchase new U.S. properties. Rosemont Realty was rechristened Gemini Rosemont. Rosemont, with its comprehensive real estate platform and superior performance history, was precisely the investment opportunity Gemini Investments was looking for in order to invest in the U.S. real estate market, declared Li Ming, Sino-Ocean Land Holdings Limited and Gemini Investments chairman. We look forward to a strong and successful partnership. The plan was to use Chinese money to acquire more properties in the United States. We see great opportunities to continue acquiring high-quality real estate in the U.S. market, one company executive said. The possibilities for this venture are tremendous. So during a critical 18-month period of diplomatic negotiations between Washington and Beijing, the Biden and Kerry families and friends pocketed major cash from companies connected to the Chinese government. The consequences of those deals are as surprising as the fact that they were conducted in the first place. 3. Nuclear and other consequences. The circle of family and confidants around Biden and Kerry participated in private deals that ended up serving Chinese military and strategic interests to the detriment of the United States. A Chinese company in which they invested was stealing U.S. nuclear secrets, according to the FBI. The partnership between American princelings and the Chinese government was just a beginning. The actual investment deals that this partnership made were even more problematic. The initial announcement of Rosemont Seneca's and the Chinese government's Bohai Harvest joint investment fund in December 2013 revealed plans for a $1 billion investment. 7 months later, they increased it to $1.5 billion. The deals began to emerge almost immediately. Many of them would have serious national security implications for the United States. Bohai Harvest RST, or BHR, with funds provided by the Chinese government, not surprisingly, gained access to private equity deals and highly prized initial public offerings, or IPOs, affected by the strategic privatization of Chinese state-owned firms. Many were listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. BHR investments generally fit a pattern of buying stakes in companies that controlled technology of interest to the Chinese government. When BHR took Chinese funds and invested in the United States, it bought up companies that fit the same profile. It is important to keep in mind that Rosemont Seneca was not passively involved in the investment decisions being made. Devon Archer, close Kerry confidant who helped run the Hines family office, served as the vice chairman of BHR, with responsibility for investments. As he has explained on his website, as vice chairman of Bohai Harvest RST, Mr. Archer helps guide one of China's most prominent mutual fund management companies. In 2015, BHR joined forces with the automotive subsidiary of the Chinese state-owned military aviation contractor, Aviation Industry Corporation of China, or AVIC, to buy American dual-use parts manufacturer Hennigus. Formed initially during the Korean War as the Bureau of Aviation Industry, AVIC is a major military contractor in China. AVIC owns 50% of the military arms business of CATIC, the China National Aerotechnology Import and Export Corporation. It operates under the direct control of the State Council and produces a wide array of fighter and bomber aircraft, transports, and drones, primarily designed to compete with the United States. The company also has a long history of stealing Western technology and applying it to military systems. The year before BHR joined with AVIC, the Wall Street Journal reported that the aviation company had stolen technologies related to the U.S. F-35 stealth fighter and incorporated them in their own stealth fighter, the J-317. AVIC has also been accused of stealing U.S. drone systems and using them to produce their own. In 2011, AVIC and the People's Liberation Army signed an Agreement on Military and Civilian Integrated Support for New Army Aviation Equipment. In short, AVIC sits at the heart of the Chinese military-industrial complex. In September 2015, when AVIC bought 51% of American precision parts manufacturer Hennigus, the other 49% was purchased by the Biden and Kerry-linked BHR. Hennigus is recognized as a world leader in anti-vibration technologies in the automotive industry and for its precise state-of-the-art manufacturing capabilities. Anti-vibration technologies are considered dual-use because they can have a military application, according to both the State Department and Department of Commerce. Part of Hennigus had previously been owned by GenCorp, an American rocket and missile manufacturer now known as Aerojet Rocketdyne Holdings, Incorporated. The technology is also on the restricted commerce control list used by the federal government to limit the exports of certain technologies. For that reason, the Hennigus deal would require the approval of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, which reviews sensitive business transactions that may have a national security implication. The U.S. intelligence community and congressional intelligence committees have long recognized that the Chinese government is committed to the acquisition of Western machine tool technology, especially those where it is difficult for outsiders to distinguish between civilian and military end uses of the equipment. According to BHR internal documents, the Hennigus deal included arduous and oftentimes challenging negotiations. The CFIUS review in 2015 included representatives from numerous government agencies, including John Kerry's State Department. The deal was approved in 2015. Then there was the involvement of Rosemont Seneca in the investment in a controversial nuclear power company. In December 2014, the Biden and Kerry-linked BHR became, in Bohai's words, an anchor investor in China General Nuclear Power Corporation, or CGNPC, or CGN, a state-owned nuclear company involved in the development of nuclear reactors. CGN had been wholly owned by the Chinese government and was now selling off a small stake to outside investors. Because the nuclear industry is considered a strategic sector in China, it would remain under the direct control of the Chinese State Council, and the government would remain the controlling shareholder. BHR also got a piece of Sichuan Sanzhou Special Steel Pipe, or SZSSP, which manufactures special piping for use in the nuclear and petrochemical industries, including cooling systems for nuclear reactors. that Kerry allies and Biden family members were making money courtesy of the Chinese government was troubling enough. The quagmire of Rosemont's participation in these sensitive Chinese industries deepens with the additional fact that CGN was under FBI investigation and eventually charged with stealing U.S. nuclear secrets. In November 2013, a Chinese-American engineer traveled to China at the expense of the Chinese government. Qing Ningwei was paid by the Chinese government for sensitive information on American nuclear technology. He worked for the Tennessee Valley Authority, or TVA, and passed along tightly controlled information concerning American nuclear reactors, which was then being transferred to CGN. Gui soon received the attention of the FBI. He eventually pleaded guilty to federal charges and would cooperate with the FBI in its broader investigation of CGN. Gui started talking and soon led the FBI to another engineer named Alan Ho, who, ironically, lived in Wilmington, Delaware, just 5 minutes from Joe Biden's house. Alan Ho, under the direction of CGN, had been working to steal American nuclear secrets since 1997. According to the FBI, he was looking for information that would help CGN's small modular reactor program, advanced fuel assembly programs, fixed in-core detector system, and verification and validation of nuclear reactor-related computer codes. These were prized secrets that engineers were not allowed to share or discuss with foreign engineers, companies, or government officials. In April 2016, Ho and CGN were charged by the U.S. Justice Department with stealing nuclear secrets from the United States. Actions prosecutors said could cause significant damage to our national security. This was no haphazard spy ring. The federal government's U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission cited the Ho case in its annual report as an example of Chinese espionage that constituted a large and growing threat to American national security. According to U.S. attorneys, CGN instructed Ho to hire American nuclear engineers as consultants and attempt to get them to share sensitive information. Other information was obtained by outright theft. Of particular interest to CGN was Westinghouse's AP-1000 system, an advanced nuclear reactor that has military application. It could be used commercially to generate power for civilians, but it also had application for developing nuclear submarines. When Ho was arrested by the FBI, he was using a random code generator so he could gain access to funds provided to him via the Bank of China. Why the Chinese interest in the Westinghouse AP-1000? Even though the AP-1000 is a civilian nuclear reactor, the design poses a dual-use concern, according to American national security officials. In other words, it could have important military applications, especially in submarines. Piping systems that were a particular target of this espionage strongly resemble the coolant pumps used in U.S. nuclear submarines. CGN's espionage efforts were intense and prolonged. According to the indictment, Ho allegedly, under the direction of CGN executives, also identified, recruited, and executed contracts with U.S.-based experts from the civil nuclear industry who provided technical assistance related to the development and production of special nuclear materials of CGNPC in China. Ho and CGNPC also allegedly facilitated the travel to China and payments to the U.S.-based experts in exchange for their services. The Obama Justice Department was blunt. Ho conspired with others to knowingly act as an agent of China. He told recruits that China has the budget to spend. According to DOJ documents, Ho made clear that he was charged with obtaining necessary expertise from the United States at the direction of the CGNPC and the China Nuclear Power Technology Research Institute, a subsidiary of CGNPC, and that he was to do so surreptitiously. It is clear from the transcripts of the FBI's interrogation of Ho that they considered the stakes in the investigation high and that what they ultimately prized was intelligence on CGN. There is no evidence that the FBI was aware at the time that Biden and Kerry family members or confidants were involved with the company. During the interrogation, FBI agents told Ho, "You give us a deep understanding of how things at CGNPC, CNPRI, how they go up, how they are, how the government of China pushes down, and how they interact. We think that you have knowledge. You've been over there a long time. You're a senior consultant to CGN, an executive consultant. I've seen pictures, I've seen emails where you talk about the CEO being your friend. The FBI was also cognizant of the fact that because CGN was a state-owned company, it was a diplomatically sensitive case, but because of its serious nature, they were intent on pursuing it. As one agent told Ho during the interrogation, "It's a big statement for the U.S. government to charge a Chinese state-owned company, and they don't take it lightly." What the Chinese government couldn't buy from the United States, it would steal. Chinese companies have a long history of stealing American nuclear secrets. As scholar Ralph Sawyer puts it in his masterful book, The Tao of Spycraft, "No nation has practiced the craft of intelligence or theorized about it more extensively than China." This time, of course, family members of America's most powerful political figures had exclusive financial interests in the rogue Chinese company stealing American secrets. Anyone with a basic knowledge of Chinese commercial espionage, particularly in a sector like nuclear power, should know that spying will play a role in the company's activities. The involvement of Kerry confidants and Biden's son in CGN should have set off alarm bells for all of them. Repeated attempts to seek comments from Joe Biden, John Kerry, Hunter Biden, Chris Hines, and Devon Archer have gone unanswered. When did the partners in Rosemont learn of CGN's intelligence activities? What we do know is that after the charges were filed and Ho pleaded guilty, Rosemont did not change its relationship with its Chinese partners, nor did BHR divest from the state-owned Chinese company that had been stealing America's nuclear secrets. In 2016, the Biden and Kerry-linked BHR made another strategic investment in unison with a Chinese state-owned company, China Molybdenum. Over the past decade, China had been in an intense race to accumulate mineral assets from around the world. China Molybdenum operates to accumulate its namesake and other rare earth minerals. Molybdenum is used to strengthen metals, particularly to make tough steel alloys, and is found as a byproduct of copper mining. During World War I, when the British introduced the tank, they made an important discovery. 1 inch of steel fused with molybdenum offered better protection against a direct hit than 3 inches of regular manganese steel. It was soon being used on a whole variety of military vehicles and applications. It is also used in the nuclear industry. The company, China Molybdenum, doesn't hide the fact that the minerals it acquires have direct military application. In its 2015 annual report, the company explains how its products are used. Molybdenum alloy steel is used for manufacturing alloy components and parts of warships, tanks, guns, and cannons, rockets, and satellites. The company is also a major producer of tungsten, which, as it points out, is widely used in military engineering. The company, as you might expect, has deep ties to the Chinese government and the Communist Party of China. China Molybdenum is China's biggest producer of molybdenum, and China and the United States have been locked in a global battle for the control of molybdenum assets. As one U.S. mining executive described it in the magazine National Defense, molybdenum, for example, is a key component in the manufacturing of armor plating. Unfortunately, it's increasingly becoming a zero-sum game to procure these minerals as demand soars and the United States' access to these resources is put in jeopardy. Just how intense is the battle between China and the United States for control of critical minerals? In 2012, President Obama entered the Rose Garden in the White House to announce that the Obama-Biden administration was filing a complaint against China with the World Trade Organization. The administration was charging Beijing with attempting to control the world rare earth minerals market, including restricting Western access to molybdenum. Japan and the European Union joined the Obama administration in the complaint, and in March 2014, the WTO ruled that China was indeed violating international agreements in what the New York Times called a hard ruling against Beijing. How ironic, then, that barely 2 years later, on May 9, 2016, China Molybdenum announced that it was buying more than half of the massive Tenke Fungurume copper mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo for $2.65 billion. Tenke is regarded as one of the world's prized copper assets. Even more ironic, a few months later, BHR announced that it was buying another 24% stake in the mine for $1.5 billion. China Molybdenum helped BHR acquire their ownership stake, thereby further consolidating Chinese control over the coveted mine. The mine is also an important source of cobalt, a critical resource for China's lithium-ion battery industry. So, while the Obama administration was laying out the challenge posed by China in the global minerals race, the son of the vice president and a confidant of the Secretary of State were invested in deals that would help Beijing win the resource race. In short, these investments served the Biden-Kerry family's investment interests and also served Chinese strategic interests. On top of it all, these deals served ultimate Chinese strategic interests by forging financial ties with the families of key American politicians. They provided a legitimizing factor, a Trojan horse, if you will, for these Chinese investments and made them seem far more benign than they actually were. Vice President Joe Biden and Secretary of State John Kerry were managing policy on America's relationship with China, while their sons and close associates were receiving deals from the Chinese government and government-related entities. The next chapter shows how the business model was not limited to China. 4. Biden's in Ukraine. While Vice President Biden was overseeing U.S. policy toward Ukraine, his son joined the board of one of Ukraine's most profitable and corrupt energy companies. The Bidens could be potential billionaires as a result of the deal. Did Joe Biden look the other way when $1.8 billion in taxpayer money disappeared? Half a world away, the father statesmen Biden and Kerry were also deeply involved in a complex and difficult situation in Ukraine. The country was facing Russian aggression in the east, political turbulence at home, and powerful oligarchs fighting over the country's resources. In the middle of it, Kerry and Biden were making critical decisions about Ukraine's future with Hunter Biden and Devon Archer on their heels. Ukraine is blessed with a treasure house of energy resources, particularly oil and natural gas. These riches are target for Russian covert operations, corrupt oligarchs, and powerful mafia dons, all who sought to control them. Burisma is a secretive Ukrainian natural gas company with deep political ties in the country, and the nation's second-largest private natural gas producer. Many of Burisma's assets are heavily concentrated in the contentious eastern reaches of the country. This border area with Russia has been the source of conflict with Moscow for decades. Burisma was created in 2006 with a Cypriot registration by Mykolas Lochevsky, the barrel-chested, bald-headed, and future ecology and natural resources minister under the pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych. How did a government minister end up owning a massive energy company? In a story far too familiar in that part of the world, Zlochevsky gave himself the licenses to develop the abundant gas fields. Of note, he took the license for the country's largest natural gas field, Sakhalinska, from someone else and gave it to a company connected to Burisma. To complete the portrait, Zlochevsky had a reputation for lavishness while in government service, with a taste for Bentleys and the occasional Rolls-Royce. His other business ventures also reflect his reputed lifestyle. He owns a super-exclusive fashion boutique in downtown Kiev named Zlochi. With chandeliers, marble-topped tables, and recessed interactive panels, Zlochi sells accessories made of alligator, ostrich, eel, and lizard. At Zlochi, a set of matching crocodile dress shoes and belt will set you back $2,800. The average Ukrainian would have to spend nearly 9 months' wages to pay for it. In 2012, President Yanukovych removed Zlochevsky as Ecology and Natural Resources Minister and appointed him to the National Security and Defense Council. But fortunately, a year earlier, the ownership structure of Burisma had been quietly transferred to a Cyprus-based company called Brositi Investments. The island nation has become a favorite venue for Russian activities, where oligarchs, mafia, government officials, and intelligence operatives park their assets because of the very tight secrecy laws. Zlochevsky's name was still attached to the company, but Burisma's major subsidiaries now listed the same business address as the natural gas firm controlled by a controversial Ukrainian oligarch named Ihor Kolomoisky. The UK's Guardian newspaper in 2015 reported Kolomoisky to be perhaps Ukraine's most troubling oligarch of all. For a country rife with corruption, war, self-dealing, and cronyism, that is saying something. But he would prove to be a worthy business partner for Joe Biden's son and John Kerry's inner circle. Pudgy, with a thick crop of silver hair, wire-frame glasses, and a tight beard, Kolomoisky was born into a family of engineers from the eastern half of Ukraine. His power base was Dnipropetrovsk, since May 2016 Dnipro, an industrial center in the country that has been cradled to a succession of powerful Ukrainian figures. It hails as the stomping ground of ex-presidents Leonid Kuchma and Oleksandr Turchynov, as well as oligarchs like Viktor Pinchuk. Before the breakup of the Soviet Union, the area was the power base for Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. Through his company, the Privyat Group, Kolomoisky controlled Ukraine's largest financial institution, Privyat Bank, through which the Ukrainian military got paid and government pensions were distributed. He also controlled media companies and airlines. Sometimes known as King Kolomoisky inside the country, his office features a gigantic shark tank, but he does most of his business from his luxurious home in Switzerland. Kolomoisky does not seem to care much for the rules. He holds Ukrainian, Israeli, and Cypriot passports, which is a problem because the Ukrainian constitution forbids dual citizenship. When asked about that fact, Kolomoisky quipped, "The constitution prohibits double citizenship, but triple citizenship is not forbidden." Kolomoisky's reportedly violent and brutal business practices stand out even in this rough corner of the globe. A British judge upbraided the billionaire for taking control of a company in Ukraine at gunpoint. Rival oligarchs have sued him in British courts, alleging that he was involved in murders and beatings in relation to a prior business deal. Kolomoisky allegedly used quasi-military teams and sent hired rowdies armed with baseball bats, iron bars, gas, and rubber bullet pistols and chainsaws to take over the Kremenchuk steel plant in 2006. He also used a mix of phony court orders, often involving corrupt judges and or registrars, and strong-arm tactics to purge rival board members. Kolomoisky vigorously denies any illegal activities. Why young Biden and those close to Kerry viewed Kolomoisky as an appropriate business partner is not known. Repeated calls and emails to both about their work with Burisma went unanswered. Kolomoisky built his multi-billion dollar empire by raiding other companies, a violent Ukrainian form of mergers and acquisitions involving guns. Matthew Verjansky, director of the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, has done an in-depth study of the practice. There are actual firms in Ukraine registered with offices and business cards, firms that specialize in various dimensions of the corporate raiding process, which includes armed guys to do stuff, forging documents, bribing notaries, bribing judges. Although the practice is common, Kolomoisky stands out. Rajansky calls him the most famous oligarch raider, accused of having conducted a massive raiding campaign over the roughly 10 years up to 2010. Given all this, it should come as no surprise that Kolomoisky's business practices have long received the attention of U.S. law enforcement officials. Because of his activities, he was eventually placed on a U.S. government visa ban list, prohibiting him from entering the country legally. As we will see, he would be taken off that list shortly after Hunter Biden and Devon Archer joined the board of his energy company. It is important to understand the events in Ukraine that were unfolding as Biden and Archer, who was on the board of the Heinz family office, joined Burisma. It may also explain why they were invited to join. In February 2014, a series of protests and strikes across western Ukraine culminated in a political revolution. President Yanukovych was chased out of office, implicated in both rampant corruption and shameless brutality. He was also very cozy with the Kremlin. He was eventually exiled to Moscow. The wave of protests brought into power a coalition government that was nationalist and determined to loosen the country's ties to Russia. Vladimir Putin, sensing an opportunity, pushed Russian military forces into the Crimean Peninsula and then the easternmost region of Ukraine. He also armed pro-Russian militias in eastern Ukraine who savagely fought the new Ukrainian government. Crimea is a strategic peninsula that offers a warm water port into the Black Sea and has long been a sought-after Russian prize. The Ukrainian government responded by mobilizing the army. There was vicious fighting in the eastern region of the country, including Dnipropetrovsk. Burisma has many of its energy assets in the area. Kolomoisky was appointed governor of Dnipropetrovsk. Never one to leave his sentiments unknown, Kolomoisky offered a $10,000 bounty for each Russian saboteur caught by the public. Putin called the billionaire a unique imposter. Kolomoisky fired back, calling the Russian president a schizophrenic, short in stature. The international community rightfully reacted to Putin's move with shock and anger. The response from Washington was almost immediate. And for Biden and Archer, there was again the opportunity to strike deals in the wake of the vice president and secretary of state's official duties. In early March, only days after the Russian move into Crimea, Secretary of State John Kerry visited Kiev, arriving with a pledge of $1 billion in American loan guarantees and offers of technical assistance. He also announced clear-cut American political and moral support for Ukraine. As he walked along Institutska Street in the heart of Kiev, a Ukrainian woman beseeched him. "We hope Russian troops will leave Crimea, and we also hope for your assistance." "We're trying very hard," Kerry responded. Kerry spoke forcefully about the U.S. commitment to an independent Ukraine, but it was Vice President Biden who would end up being point person in the Obama administration's policy toward Ukraine. No one in the U.S. government has wielded more power over Ukraine than Vice President Joe Biden, noted Foreign Policy magazine. Indeed, his power as it relates to Ukrainian policy extended far beyond just Washington. He was considered the voice of the country's Western backers. Biden consulted regularly with the Ukrainian president by telephone and made 5 trips to the Ukraine between 2014 and 2017. He did so at the same time that his son and his son's business partners prepared to strike a profitable deal with controversial and reportedly violent oligarchs Kolomoisky and Zlochevsky, who would benefit from his actions. On April 16, 2014, Devon Archer made a private visit to the White House for a meeting with Vice President Biden. We do not know the duration because, according to White House records, the meeting lasted until 11:59 p.m., the end-of-the-day placeholder when the meeting's end was not recorded. Less than a week later, on April 22nd, there was a public announcement that Devon Archer had been asked to join the board of Burisma. 3 weeks after that, on May 13th, it was announced that Hunter Biden would join too. Neither Biden nor Archer had any background or experience in the energy sector. As was the case with their deals in China, the foreign company, Burisma here, did not hide the fact that the son of the vice president and the financial manager for the family of the American Secretary of State were joining the board. Far from it. They mentioned it in the first paragraph of their press release, as translated, "Devon Archer is an iconic figure in American politics today. According to U.S. media, he is the part of the Family Foundation directorship Hines Family Office with Christopher Hines, John Kerry's stepson, the current U.S. Secretary of State. He has served as senior advisor to John Kerry and in 2004 during the presidential campaign. Today he is the co-founder and managing director of Rosemont Seneca Partners, where his partner is Hunter Biden, the son of the current U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden." The timing of the announcement is significant. The day before, on April 21st, Vice President Joe Biden landed in Kiev for a series of high-level meetings with Ukrainian officials. The vice president was bringing with him highly welcome terms of a United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, program to assist the Ukrainian natural gas industry, and promises of more U.S. financial assistance and loans. Soon, the United States and the International Monetary Fund would be pumping more than $1 billion into the Ukrainian economy. The younger Biden, for his part, tried to put the best possible face on the deal. He claimed that by joining the board of the scandal-laden natural gas producer, he would contribute to the economy and benefit the people of Ukraine. Biden also said that his role would be consulting the company on matters of transparency, corporate governance and responsibility, international expansion, and other priorities. His responsibilities also included providing support for the company among international organizations. At other times, they would describe his role as offering strategic guidance to Burisma. Biden and Archer's appointment to the Burisma board did not go unnoticed in China, where Rosemont Seneca enjoyed continuing progress with its BHR investment fund with the Chinese government. The Chinese government media ran several stories about Biden's Ukrainian venture. The main Chinese government news outlet, China Daily, noted, "The decision immediately sparked speculation over whether the U.S. government had a role in Hunter Biden's promotion, as his father has frequently spoken about the need to increase Ukraine's energy independence." Another ally of Secretary of State Kerry was soon added to the Burisma payroll. Less than a month after Kerry's protege Archer joined the board, Burisma hired a new lobbyist in Washington named David Leiter, a former Senate chief of staff for Kerry. Burisma's access to the corridors of power halfway around the world in Washington was looking bright. At the end of June, four U.S. senators, Senators Markey, Shaheen, Wyden, and Murphy, drafted a letter to President Obama requesting greater U.S. aid for the Ukrainian energy industry. In a statement, Burisma immediately applauded the range of U.S. legislative support for development of Ukraine's broad and untapped resources and an increase in transparency and good governance. In 2016, Burisma organized and co-sponsored Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's meeting with top U.S. lawmakers in Washington. In an event in the Congressional Auditorium at the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center, Devon Archer joined Poroshenko and members of Congress and the U.S. Senate to discuss Ukrainian issues. The choice of Hunter Biden to handle transparency and corporate governance for Burisma is curious, because Biden had little, if any, experience in Ukrainian law or professional legal counsel, period. He seemed undeterred by the fact that, as he was joining the Burisma board, the British government's Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, was seizing $23 million from Zlochevsky's bank accounts. The SFO was also seeking access to his Swiss bank accounts and the company's account at BNP Paribas in London. British officials aggressively pursued the case for more than a year but ran into a roadblock when Ukrainian prosecutors refused to cooperate in the investigation. By January 2015, the SFO had unblocked the accounts. Doing business in the Ukraine is not for the faint of heart. According to the World Economic Forum, Ukraine is one of the most corrupt places in the world. Out of 148 nations studied, it ranks 122 for diversion of public funds, 143 for property rights, 130 for irregular payments and bribes, 133 for favoritism in decisions of government officials, that is, cronyism, 146 for protection of minority shareholders' interests. As one Reuters writer put it, corruption in Ukraine is so bad a Nigerian prince would be embarrassed. Indeed, Ukraine was rated as more corrupt than Nigeria by Transparency International. But even in such a corrupt climate, Burisma seems to stand out. Biden and Archer were joining one of the most corrupt firms in a very corrupt country. 1 year after Hunter Biden joined the firm to offer help on compliance and legal matters, experienced industry observers warned investors that Burisma was still a company to be avoided. Anyone considering investing in Ukrainian gas or this influential player, Burisma, should understand that the next stop for their money will be Switzerland, declared one industry publication. It went on. Burisma, registered in Cyprus in 2006, fails to pass the most basic due diligence check. Its registration documents are impossible to run down. It publishes no asset information or financial records, nor does it release any audited financial statements. The complete lack of transparency means that anyone interested, including potential investors, must rely solely on press releases about Burisma's future plans and intentions. It was hardly what you would call a ringing endorsement. Yaroslav Udovenko, managing director of the investment firm Empire State Capital Partners in Kiev, says there is a very short list of legitimate gas companies in Ukraine. Burisma isn't on it.